from the Wormy Studios of Univest at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another invasive episode of Chemical-Free Horticultural Hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. Yet another journal article has appeared pointing out the dangers of alien earthworms. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll reveal what's really happening in Worm World and whether these creatures are friend or foe. Plus, your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and craftily composed considerations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens, because it's all coming up faster than you trying to wrangle an Asian jumping worm right after this.
J.L. Hudson Seeds has supported You Bet Your Garden and enthusiastic growers for more than 25 years. To learn more about the world's most eclectic seed company, visit jlhudsonseeds.net.
Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, this has been a topic of controversy for years now. We know that there are alien invasive earthworms all over North America. But what should we do about them, if anything? I'll tell you the surprising answer after a couple of your fabulous phone calls. 888-492-9444. Jill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Ah, thank you, Mike. How are you?
I'm just ducky. Thanks for asking, Jill. Although it's not really ducky weather here. Ducky prefers to go in a pond that's not frozen. So, well. And where is Jill?
I'm in Mount Vernon, Virginia.
Oh.
Alexandria, Virginia.
Okay. And, you know, just outside of D.C., really, right?
Yep. Just a couple miles south.
A couple miles south of D.C.
Yeah.
Okay. And what can we do you for?
I was wondering how to eradicate wiregrass out of my yard and my flower beds.
Oh. Doesn't anybody screen these calls? Oh, dear. You had to pick one of the most difficult weeds of all time. Okay, so you say, let's start with the lawn. What kind of a lawn do you have? Do you know?
A green one? No. One that it has bluegrass in it. It also has fescue and a lot of wiregrass.
Well, a lot of wiregrass is bad. How long have you been letting this slide?
I have been fighting it for 10 years.
Oh, okay. With no success.
With no success.
Yeah. It is a tough weed. Okay. So, lawn care basics. Who cuts your lawn?
I do, and my son.
Okay.
And
what do you
use? I cut it to, like, I use a lawnmower.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're all lawnmowers. Oh, you use a push mower?
Not you know, a motorized push.
Oh, yeah, walk behind.
Not a ride on, but a walk behind, yeah.
Yeah, walk behind. And how high do you cut the grass?
I cut it to 4 inches, and my son cuts it a little lower.
Okay. Well, 3.5 to 4 inches should be fine. Do you water your lawn?
No.
And have you ever been to Kentucky? Oh, boy, this is a tough one. how big is the lawn itself?
I have about a half acre.
Oh, okay. How much of it is, like, visible near the house?
It's all of it.
Well, no, generally, for instance, when you got a weed like this, it's most obvious where you're walking when you look down. Once you get about 50 feet away, it just kind of blends in with everything else.
Right.
Now, remind me about wiregrass. I haven't had to deal with this for a long time. I'm thinking it's a wiry weed that intertwines with your grass.
Yes, it's like a wild Bermuda grass.
Mm-hmm.
It's like long strips of root.
Mm-hmm.
And when you dig it up, if you don't get the entire thing, where you cut it will turn into two roots from where you cut it.
Now it's
so if you don't get the entire root system, it'll come back in more force.
Yeah.
Like.
No, I mean this is a tough one. You know, if you had a small lawn, I would even suggest you cut it down to the bare bones, till it up and solarize it. If you get full sun where you are, you could solarize your lawn to be weed and pest free in a single summer season. And I'm thinking that maybe you want to really map out the area that is important to you and drive edging into the outside area, you know, to kind of keep the wire grass at bay, deep edging, and then do that. You'd have to give up your lawn for a season, but the only thing involved is the initial work, and then you're just baking it. So for the sake of making myself clear, teaching people who want to do this, what you would do is you would mow your lawn down to dirt, the area that you want to solarize. You know, I want to see dirt blowing out the back of the mower. And then you would till it up and, you know, pick out any green material that's easily pick outable and compost it or trash it. But you don't have to be perfect. What you do have to be perfect about is leveling it. It has to be perfectly level. Then you saturate this new bed that you've made with water. And I can't explain strongly enough how saturated that means. The soil starting out should be 100% saturated. And then you would cover that area with clear plastic, either 2 or 3 mils thick, M-I-L. Not black plastic, not a tarp, not 1 mil because it would not survive the summer, but 2 or 3 mil plastic, and then use bricks or rocks or something to make sure the sides stay tight. And then you just let summer heat bake that area. And in September or October, you would start out with a clean slate, which would be good because that's exactly the time to sow the seed of a new cool season lawn, which is what you have. More fescue, more bluegrass. I'm surprised the bluegrass isn't outpacing or at least holding its own over the wiregrass. Come to think of it, in your situation, I would recommend bluegrass exclusively because fescue is a clumping grass and it doesn't spread. So if you're hoping to keep out a spreader, you plant a better spreader, so to speak.
Okay.
If that's too much, you could, let's see, your lawn is going to be strongest in the cool weather and weakest in the hot weather, whereby I kind of remember that wiregrass likes it hot. So planting in October, November, would be ideal. And again, planting bluegrass. Now, riddle me this. How do you feed your lawn?
I leave the grass clippings down, and then I put, like, compost on it.
Yeah, but you're leaving the wiregrass clippings down.
Right, which is a problem.
I think that might be the problem. Let's change you over to a bagging mower and feed your lawn exclusively with compost. Compost your clippings and the wiregrass together in a dedicated area. Make sure the wiregrass doesn't sprout. And then I would overseed in the fall with more bluegrass. If you're not helping the wiregrass propagate and you are adding a grass that will compete with it, I don't think it'll take 10 years to get rid of it. I think I'm thinking more like 3 if we follow either of these plans.
Okay.
Sorry.
I do have one question.
Go ahead.
Okay, so if when I solarize, I saturate the entire area heavily with water.
Mm-hmm.
Do I resaturate it?
No, you don't.
I mean, do I keep it moist the entire time?
No, that's one.
No. Okay.
One real benefit of this is you just sit on your hands all summer in regards to this piece of property.
Okay.
All right. I wish I had a magic answer.
Me too.
All right. Take care and good luck.
All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Little bugs. Two little bugs. Two little bugs in a box.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and send a shout out to the folks who run the Connecticut Garden Show, where I recently appeared. They went above and beyond to make me feel comfy and well cared for. But don't go sending them a thank you card just yet, because we'll be right back with the real story behind invasive earthworms and more of your invasive phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studio at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA.
J.L. Hudson Seeds has supported You Bet Your Garden and enthusiastic growers for more than 25 years. To learn more about the world's most eclectic seed company, visit jlhudsonseeds.net.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit, we will delve into the thorny issue of alien earthworms. You may think you know what's going on, but you probably don't. And I'll tell you what it's all about after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls, 888-492-9444. Ryan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening for about 10 years, so this is pretty exciting.
Oh, well, thank you. The excitement is all mine. Where are you, sir?
I'm calling from Massachusetts, and the garden in question is out on Outer Cape Cod, way out near Provincetown.
Okay. How far out on Cape Cod?
It takes me about a half hour to bike into Provincetown, so way out there.
I was thinking more on the water.
Oh, we're about a mile in from the water.
Okay. All right. That's a rough climate.
Yeah, pretty sandy, but very beautiful. We're in an RV park in like a pitch pine forest that is really great, and there's great birding, and I love it out there.
Okay, that sounds nice. So what can we do you for?
So we have the seasonal site. This past year was our first full season. The previous tenants planted a lot of big, great stuff. It's beautiful, gives us lots of privacy. But I'm into the birds and the bugs, and so we're replacing what we can with more native plants. Up on my target list next year is the ornamental pear tree, which is the one I hate the most, I think. The campground said they'll cut it down, but it is right in the front of our campsite and gives us a lot of privacy. So I'm hoping I can get some advice on how to replace that privacy with some native plants in some way, given that those pear tree roots are going to be in the soil after.
Yeah, there's a couple of things here. First, everybody is right. The tree must come down. I did one of those in the news segments a while back where...
Yep.
Oh, so you remember that?
I sure do, yeah. As soon as I saw it, I was like, that's got to come down.
Yep. Worse than murder hornets was the tongue-in-cheek title of a U.S. Department of Agriculture webinar in 2020 about caliper pears, including the 24 thornless ornamental varieties sold since the 1960s. Now, these trees should be named after Jeff Goldblum, because they personify him warning everybody that this was all going to fall apart and them not listening. Nature finds a way. What people loved about these trees was their caliper shape. They have a beautiful shape. There's no getting around it. They really do provide a lot of cover just beginning at the right height. And the flowers are beautiful in the spring as long as you don't smell them, because they are pollinated by flies. And to attract the flies, they give off the sweet scent of rotting flesh. But they were bred to be sterile, okay? No harm. Plant one, nothing else is going to happen. But nature found a way. And they began to cross-pollinate between specific name varieties. And now we have entire fields that used to be farm fields that are nothing but a lawn of baby caliper pears. They are destroying the environment in so many areas. I'm happy to hear that you only have one. But, it should come down. God bless the Park Service for offering. How tall is this puppy?
I would say it's about 20 feet tall.
Yeah, I mean, that's great to get somebody else to do for you. And I am concerned, and you should be concerned about the fact that after it's cut down, it will probably try to send up shoots from the ground to try and reestablish itself. So, if you could convince them to pull up the stump, that would be a double mitzvah, because then you wouldn't have to worry about these opportunistic sprouts. Otherwise, I seem to remember our tree guy Lee Reich saying that they will not come back, or there's less a chance of these sprouts coming back if you snap them off rather than cutting them off, as cutting promotes the production of a hormone that makes the underground root system want to make more. And, of course, the lazy man's way is also the rope-a-dope. You know, as soon as you see these things emerge, you run them over with a lawnmower or a brush mower. And, you know, after a year or two, you'll exhaust the root system and they won't bother you again. Now,
perfect.
As to what to replace it with, it occurs to me again that you can't really replace it with anything if you leave the stump in the ground.
Right.
Because then you got a big plug in your planting hole. So if if they have the equipment and they're only technically appointed to cut it down, see if you can cut a deal for you to pay to have the stump pulled at the same time. They certainly wouldn't object, and it'll save you a lot of time and money.
Right. I had thought of that, but the soil is so sandy, and the campsite, everything's kind of packed in there. So it's actually right next to where our RV is mounted, and it's pretty close to where we have a deck. So I'm worried if they pull it out and all this sand resettles, it'll be a little unstable for how much other stuff is nearby.
Well, another technique, we haven't talked about this in a while, is once they cut the stump down to a couple inches off the ground, to take a chainsaw and make lateral cuts in the top of the stump. Now, other people will tell you to pour terrible things on top of that, but you don't have to. The cuts will allow rainwater, and especially where you are, freeze and thaw cycles to make life miserable for the stump underground. So now you're in a pitch pine forest. I'm very familiar with those. They are a unique ecosystem. What else? But they don't grow tall enough for you, right?
So actually we have some at our site too. I love them. One of the reasons, another like bonus reason to get rid of this pear tree is just because of how unique the existing ecosystem is. So we have some trees that are about 25 feet tall near the campsite. A few of those, which are really beautiful, and hummingbirds nest in them, and they're great.
Okay. Well, then your job is to replace it with the most mature pitch pine you can afford, because that is your ecosystem there. That is what's supposed to be there naturally. And you'd be doing some good restoration work. And again, maybe the Park Service would help you out there.
That's a good point.
They want to restore it to its natural features. And so maybe they will, you know, either provide the tree or go 50-50 with you or something like that. But they will also have a reliable supplier on hand.
Yeah, of the right kind of tree and everything.
Now, here's my other suggestion. You know, cut the tree down in the winter before it can produce those flowers and maybe pollinate a tree somewhere nearby. And then, and I'm not allowed to say that, I'm sure this is federally illegal in so many ways. I used a cowboy gardening technique in a situation like this, where I got the longest chainsaw I could borrow. I certainly wasn't going to use one of mine. And made a circle as deep as I could using the chainsaw around the stump. Then, because of the sandy nature of your soil, you might be able to get it up. You might be able to cut the stump into pieces that you can pull up. But it's not going to have a good day when you're done. It's not going to be a happy stump.
I'm worried, too, about, right, because the pitch pines that are there have pretty big root systems all over. And I'm also worried about, you know, they have a tough enough life out on the Cape as it is. I'm kind of worried of doing damage underground.
You can root prune an existing tree by as much as 30% and not harm it.
Oh, okay.
My house abuts, and I mean you can reach out from one of our doors and touch it, a giant tulip poplar that I wanted to save when we put that addition on the house. And I had an arborist friend come by, and when the roots were exposed for the construction, he cut off with a chainsaw like one-third of them that were near where they had to pour the foundation, and then covered the cut parts with white latex paint and filled it back in with dirt. And it's perfect. I mean, people come by and they go, I mean, this tree is massive. It must be 90 feet tall. And, of course, the trunk closest to the house looks like a giant redwood. I mean, you could carve a hole in it for dwarves to pass through. So, but also seek their advice. But I would say that because of the synergy you have going between your existing trees, I would desperately try to put another pitch pine in.
Okay. If I can't get buy-in from the campground to dig it out, I was thinking maybe putting like a trellis there somehow and maybe like training things up it and put a container on the stump, try to hide it. But I think anything I train up it would need to go in a container because all those roots, right?
Well, now, are we talking about mostly privacy in the warmer months?
Yeah.
Because you could indeed put a container on top of the stump, as big a container as it can handle, and then, yes, you could grow things like ornamental pole beans, like scarlet runner beans, which also attract hummingbirds.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about them a lot.
And that would look great in the summertime. But yeah, if you make the container big enough and you avoid the native soil, you don't have to worry about the stump or the pine roots.
Okay. And if...
last one, we got to go.
Growing up, so yeah. If that's growing up something to get the height I want, can I just like cut that in the winter and like move the container somewhere more sheltered?
No.
Or just kind of replace? No.
Yes and no. Yes
and
no.
For the best.
You would. Well, no. It's just like in my garden. You would take down the trellis in the fall and store the container, and then start over again the next spring.
Okay, perfect. Hey, I really appreciate your time, Mike. Thank you so much.
All right. You take care, man. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
888-492-9444. Dorothy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, thank you, Dorothy. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
And where is Dorothy doing well?
I am located here in Seacane, Pennsylvania.
All right. So what can we do for Dorothy in PA?
I have a alocasia, hope I pronounced it correctly, Hilo Beauty. It's a house plant.
Right.
Okay. And here I have, since I've had it, it had three leaves, stems with the leaf to it.
Right.
And then slowly two of the leaves have turned brown, a light color brownish, and then they kind of die off on me. And I have one stem with the leaf on it, and the ends of the leaf are curling in.
Yes. That's very common. Your plant has symptoms of two problems. One is overwatering, especially in the wintertime. Every 10 days may seem like, oh, my God, I'm really pushing the window here. But I have, for instance, a snake plant in my dining room that only gets watered two or three times a year. Most house plants really despise having wet feet, and they should never be watered until their soil is completely dry and their roots are allowed to dry off. Is it near a heat vent or anything like that?
No, it just sits. It used to sit on a windowsill over, not as an actual window, but it cut it out by my sink.
So here's what I want you to do. I want you to humor me and take the plastic pot out of the ceramic vase and just let it sit out like that. Do you put your finger down into the soil to see if it's still moist?
I can do that, and I also have a moisture meter.
Yeah, there are differences of opinion on how well they work. But again, with houseplants, the less you water, the better it's going to be. And leaves, plants don't like to be moved. So if the first two leaves fell off shortly after you brought it into the house, that was just the stress of being moved. But what I want you to do, what I want you to do now is spread out some newspaper over your kitchen counter, lift the plastic pot out of the ceramic vase, and then gently pour the soil out of the plastic pot. If it's wet, that's the problem. And then I would say just gently brush off all of the soil attached to the roots and see if there's any root rot. You would be able to see it right away. It's black and it's nasty. And
right.
If you do have root rot, you want to put that under running room strength, room temperature, tap water, and just feel it around with your hands on your fingers until you get any bad parts off. And then I would repot it into fresh soil, let it in a plastic pot with good drainage, and then let that sit in the sink full of your rainwater or whatever for maybe half an hour. And then lift it out, put it on a saucer. If any water appears in the saucer, pour that off. And then maybe don't put it back in the same spot. Maybe the hutch with your other plants is the best place. They can encourage it. Don't be surprised if it doesn't recover. And it's quite possible that it came with a warranty, so I would contact the people who sold it to you and ask for a replacement, which will be easier to care for once we get into the spring and summer.
Thanks very much, Mike.
My pleasure. You take care now. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and shout out to the listeners who packed my recent lectures at the Connecticut Flower Show in Hartford. All three talks wound up being standing room only, and some folks said they had driven quite a distance just to see me. Aw, shucks. But don't go sorting your seed packets just yet, because we'll be right back with the real deal about allegedly invasive alien earthworms and more of your wormy phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA.
This is 91.3 FM, WLVR Bethlehem, WLVR.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will delve into the thorny issue of alien earthworms. You may think you know what's going on, but you probably don't. And I'll tell you what it's all about after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls, 888-492-9444. Philip, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. I've enjoyed your program multiple times.
Well, thank you, sir. We've enjoyed you listening. Where are you, Phil?
Right now I'm in Brentwood, Tennessee. It's just south of Nashville, about 20 miles south of downtown Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay. And what can we do you for?
I'm curious about, it's a Norfolk pine. It was given to me at my father's death about 21 years ago. It has grown very tall and spindly. It's got multiple leaves on it. Unfortunately, it has been at my son, daughter-in-law, and grandson's house where we're building a retirement apartment. It has not been watered. I've been watering it more regularly now, and I still have quite a bit of green. I considered maybe taking a picture and emailing the picture, but it has grown very tall. Most of the leaves are in the top, or not the leaves, the limbs. There's limbs that come out of the stalk, in essence, or the trunk.
Right. Now,
And I'm wondering about pruning it back to see if I can sort of rejuvenate it.
No.
I was certain that you could help me. But
yes, I can, but no to pruning. Now, it's the Norfolk pine is not from Norfolk, Virginia. It's from an island off of Australia, and it's very tropical, which is why people use them as a house plant. They also do give them as gifts, and people buy them around Christmas time because of their unique habit. Now, what you're describing as the sparseness of the limbs is not sparseness. I mean, that's how it's supposed to grow. That's how the plant is supposed to look. And a lot of times, it under the, well, I was going to say right conditions, but wrong conditions, it'll get even, quote, leggier. It is bad to let it dry out completely. Unlike a lot of other house plants, this one doesn't store water. So you want to keep the top of the soil. Well, don't worry if the top of the soil is dry, but you want there to be some moisture in the pot to keep this tropical plant happy. Now, roughly how tall is it?
Probably 2.5, maybe almost 3 feet.
Oh, but it's stayed compact in size over the years.
Well, it has. And part of it is it's probably about a 10 to 12 inch pot. And it does have, in essence, like a trail on the bottom, because I water it until I see pour water in it until I see water coming up into that reservoir in the base.
Mm-hmm. If you're going to rely on that type of watering, if the soil in a houseplant is bone dry, all the water is just going to go through right away. The way to effectively water a plant like that is to get a regular drinking glass. And then when you think it's time to water, you just pour like a quarter of the water in that drinking glass into the pot. And then you go watch a TV show, I don't know, play solitaire, whatever, and come back like 20 minutes later and do another quarter and repeat that until the glass is empty. What's happening here is you're pouring water on a dry sponge. As you know from washing your dishes and stuff, it doesn't soak in. But if you do it very slowly, the water will stay where you want it and it will saturate the soil. One of the bad things about just dumping some water in and walking away is you didn't really water the plant. You know, it all left via the bottom right away.
Okay, so, that makes a lot of sense.
Now, you said almost all the limbs are still green. Does that mean some of them are brown?
Some of them are brown. That's correct.
Where are they?
Well, in different places. And I guess I could go in there. And it seems
No, it's okay.
Okay.
No, but tell me what you remember.
There are 10 or 12 limbs, and it's maybe four or five that are, some of them are very, quite a bit of green. I may need to add additional soil to the pot, too. I mean, that's part of where I was. I'm not, both of my wives were horticulturists, and I had a neighbor as well, but he's moved to California.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of the triple whammy, unfortunately, for my Norfolk. And I would like to try to rejuvenate it. It was a gift from my department when my father died.
Right. I understand that. Where is the brownness? Is it on the bottom of the plant? Is it on the tips of the limbs?
Most of the limbs are brown. Should I maybe go ahead and prune them off? Or
you're never going to get a good shape back. Now, when you say they're brown, if you touch that limb, will the dry needles fall off?
I don't think so, because I have moved them around a little bit. What I've tried to do also is turn the plant, since it's indoors now. I mean, it's definitely not going to like outside. And it's the best light that I get is by a sliding glass door.
The only advice I can give you, if there are completely brown limbs towards the bottom, I would prune those off. If one of the limbs just has a little bit of brown on the edge, you can carefully trim that off. But in terms of quote-unquote pruning, this is not a plant that gets pruned. And again, how many times over the last year have we talked about the danger of plants being given in memory of someone? If this keeps going south, I would advise you to just replace it with a new one. Nobody's going to know unless you tell them it's the same kind of plant, has the same kind of memory. And pay more attention to watering it correctly and keep it away from sources of heat and cold, like air conditioning and hot air vents.
Okay. Well, that's part of it, too, because the plant was moved from, because it has done well until I moved it over about 2 years ago, where I had sold my house earlier than I had planned, and we didn't have my retirement apartment completed, and the plant was put in the retirement area.
So okay.
It has been probably cooler and warmer than the rest of the home.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
so maybe what I should do is let it. It may be there's always an end to everything, and it may be that is the issue.
But
and that's unfortunate.
But in the meantime, move it into a correct space somewhere in that house. You essentially just abandoned it for 2 years. You can't expect it to be really happy with you. Move it back into a good space. See if you begin to get good, healthy new growth, and then wait it out and see what happens. And if it never looks good, replace it with the exact same plant, but read up on how to care for it.
I'm going to do that, and that's very good. Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Mike. And my mantra is, have a fun, safe weekend.
You too, sir. Bye-bye. All right. It is time for the question of the week, which we are calling, what should we do about worms from out of town? Dan in Dayton, Ohio writes, I recently saw an article on invasive worms. I've always loved having earthworms in my dirt, but have I been making the problem worse? Also, I have no idea what native worms look like. Can they be purchased? Are they as good? The article is titled, non-native earthworms are all over North America, and it's a problem. Well, at first, I thought Dan was referring to a study that's been floating around for quite a few years. But this is a new one, published just this year in the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution. I quote from the article's abstract, 70 alien earthworm species have colonized the North American continent. They have larger geographic ranges than native species and novel ecological functions, representing a serious threat to the biodiversity and functioning of native ecosystems. Note my emphasis of native ecosystems here. They're not talking about farms and gardens. They continue, earthworms and probably other soil organisms constitute a major but overlooked pool of invasive species that are not adequately managed by existing controls and mitigation strategies. All right, hold up. Mitigation? As I have said about previous studies looking into this issue, how the devil are you going to control earthworms without massive destruction of the environment you're trying to save? The authors estimate that alien earthworms are prevalent in roughly 73% of North America. Only 3% of native species dominate areas of North America, while 28% of the areas studied are, quote, devoid of any native species. Oddly enough, they note that alien worms are twice as prevalent in Canada as opposed to the U.S. In general, they add, alien species seem to greatly prefer cooler northern climates. Overall, aliens represent 23% of the 308 worm species in North America. But, the researchers add, those aliens cover such a large area that they account for 12 of 13 most widespread species. The authors note that these non-native earthworms arrived mostly from Europe and Asia over the past 200 years. The big difference between them and natives is that the natives live underground and process and reprocess soil. The non-native worms prefer working in leaf litter and duff, which is the top inches of material on the forest floor. As a result, these non-natives make soil richer, but also make natural forest mulches disappear faster. The researchers describe what this means to us in very clear language. Non-native earthworms are beneficial to farmers and gardeners by enriching the soil faster than natives could. But they are possibly detrimental in wild natural areas where they change the ecology of the forest floor. In conclusion, they note that we can do nothing to eliminate the existing population of non-native worms, but that we can slow it down by using good practices that have been recommended for decades, like not disposing of leftover fishing worms in the environment. Maybe you fisher people out there should keep a little indoor bait garden, then you wouldn't have to buy new worms all the time. Another thing that seemed to be strongly suggested was to not add worm bin worms, red wigglers, to your garden. Otherwise, they point out that climate change may slow their spread, as they definitely prefer areas with cooler weather, which, as we know, is getting scarcer all the time. But basically, we have to accept that our environment is in a constant state of change and always has been. A lot of what was native a century ago is long gone, and that pace will only increase. We move on to Leslie near Downingtown, PA, who writes, I heard about Asian jumping worms last fall and then found some of them in my raised bed garden in October. I took out as many as I could find, it was a lot, and put them into a bucket with vinegar. Some of the soil now looks like coffee grounds, as I was told it would. Now I'm concerned about this year's garden. I'm told that I could get rid of them by solarizing the soil over 100 degrees. Any other ideas? Soil solarization is not as easy as you imply. You would not be able to use that bed for a full season, and it would only work if your summer were more sunny than usual. And when you remove the clear plastic that you were using to try and cook the soil, the jumpers would quickly return. As one of Star Trek's most popular alien species, the Borg, have famously said, resistance is futile. I hate to be direct, but you're wasting your time trying to achieve an endless task. And as the researchers note, these non-native worms are beneficial in managed horticulture, like farms and gardens. I'm somewhat puzzled by all these scare stories making their way into newspaper articles, which seem to be written by people who clearly haven't read the actual studies. When I was back working at Rodale Press, our publisher, the late, great Robert Rodale, would always tell us not to present a problem unless you can also present a solution, which in this case, like much of gardening, is just leave it alone. Well, that sure was a story that should help gardeners relax a little bit about the worms in their life now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read it over at your leisure or your leisure. To do so, just visit the Gurney's website. That's G-U-R-N-E-Y-S, and click on Garden Resources. Or you can type Gurney's plus You Bet Your Garden into your favorite search engine. Yikes, my producer is threatening to steeplechase my jumping worms if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 888-492-9444 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse of a question, teeming to our garden shores at mikemcg@ptd.net. That's MIKEMCG at peterthomasdavid.net. Please include your phone number and location. You'll find all of our updated contact information, plus audio of this show, audio and video of previous shows, and links to our internationally renowned podcast. It's all at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the Univest Studios at Lehigh Valley Public Media in Bethlehem, PA. Our radio show is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created while eating Swanson TV dinners and watching Science Fiction Week on The Early Show. King of the Late Late Show is our musical director, Ken Queter. Our chief content officer is Yoni Greenbaum. Our angel of the airways is Christine Dempsey. And our engineer is Cheerful Charlie Sarah. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Check out her fine work and keep up with our updated contact information. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our peerless princess of profound production is Jasmine Griffin. Our irreplaceable audio editor is the lovely Jonas Bowen. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be busy starting my tomato seeds while mourning the loss of a lilac, part of a white pine, and half of a rhododendron, all beaten down by a recent doubleheader of a total 2-foot snowstorm. Until I can see you again next week. Wow.